Oh boy. The inbox is overflowing. So this one could take the night. And very important, you know, and worth giving whatever time we have to it. Where does compassion and loving kindness fit into the Mahamudra practices? Are these more the Yidam practice in Vajrayana, or is there some practice more specific to Mahamudra? Or does one simply let compassion be realized as co-emergent with the emptiness realized from Mahamudra practice? So, several questions there. So probably should talk more about Dzogchen. I'll just some random thoughts about it first. So in Dzogchen, and I don't know whether this schema goes over to Mahamudra exactly like this or not, but there are the nine jhanas of that are talked about in the Nyingma tradition. And so the nine jhanas are the nine vehicles. And so the first of these, or you could say the first two of them, are Theravadin. So basically it's the whole path. The nine jhanas are the whole path of Buddhism, really. And the first two would be the Shravakayana and the Pratyeka Buddha jhana. And then the third is the Mahayana. And so a practitioner of Dzogchen, which is the ninth jhana and the pinnacle, the great perfection, in you could say transcends but includes all of the lower jhanas as well. And so all of the practices of the Bodhisattva jhana would be practiced and familiar by a Dzogchenpa. So, and then beyond that, basically beyond the Mahayana, all of the other jhanas are Vajrayanas, and varying degrees of subtlety, you could say. And with the ninth jhana then being Ati Yoga. And Ati Yoga then is Dzogchen. So a practitioner of Ati Yoga will have, you know, realized the importance of the Mahayana in compassion and the Bodhisattva jhana, and basically traversed that and studied that for you know, a long time and practiced it. And then just more random thoughts. So when you're practicing, practicing the Mahayana, one of the things that you come up against is how long it takes to get the ultimate result. So three periods of countless eons, you know, so basically unimaginable length of time. And we'll talk more about that, why that is tomorrow from the perspective of Mahamudra, why it would take so long on that path versus this particular path within the Vajrayana. But basically the motivation for anyone to practice Vajrayana is how fast it is. And so when you are really powerfully motivated by compassion, then are you going to be content with basically filling up eternity with your own development? Or are you, if there is a speedier way of traversing the entire path to liberation, aren't you naturally going to be moved by compassion to take that? So that is kind of the basic, you know, motivation with that would motivate a practitioner to undertake the Vajrayana in the first place. It's just that it's promised the potential of it. You know, of course, not everybody who practices Vajrayana does it, pulls it off. You know, it's still, there are, you know, not everybody's a Mahasiddha. But the potential is there in the design of the program. And we'll talk more about that again tomorrow. So compassion would lead you to practice Mahamudra Dzogchen as the pinnacle of all the Vajrayana practices. So you could say that. And then another random thought, just about the relationship of Mahamudra Dzogchen and compassion. His Holiness the Dalai Lama has said, when you have a taste of nirvana, your compassion explodes. It's supernovas. So why would that be? So, well, okay. So first of all, remember what the definition of liberation was that of Gyatro Rinpoche gave to us today. And what is the definition of samsara? You know, it is conceptuality, being enmeshed or mired in conceptuality and believing it to be true, or being free of conceptual elaboration and resting in that non-conceptual state. So when you are able to rest in that non-conceptual state, let's just say your state of stillness today that you might have sampled, you are getting a taste of nirvana. And if that you really grok that, it will rock your world, right? Because you realize this is what's suffering. This is the root of suffering, is this obsession with the delusion that is propagated by the conceptual mind and this confusion, believing it to be true, that the conceptual projection is actually somehow real things out there, independent of my mind, and that I just put all of my time into managing these so-called external things. And you realize that it will just hit you like lightning, that all the suffering of your life has been caused by that mistake, by that delusion. And so if you can have, that's why if you glimpse that in stillness, your compassion mushrooms, explodes, because you realize that everybody has, and especially so in Mahamudra and Dzogchen, the other thing that is so tightly linked with this is the view of Buddha nature. And so everybody that you know, everybody in this room, everybody outside this room, already, the nature of their mind is Dharmakaya. It's already there. The three bodies of the Buddha are already their birthright. But everybody, you know, most people don't recognize that. And so if you glimpse that, if you just get a little taste of that yourself, then naturally you just feel this overwhelming compassion for everybody who is just missing what is manifestly present, what is there waiting to be discovered. So, you know, I think that's what His Holiness is referring to there, that when you glimpse that, get a taste of nirvana, you're just overwhelmed with how pointless this suffering is, how needless it is. Why can't everybody just wake up? You know, really, why can't everybody just wake up to what's there waiting to be discovered? And so I think that's Mahamudra, right? You get quickly, in Dzogchen, quickly, these tastes of nirvana, and then it just opens your heart to the heartbreaking state of delusion in most people's minds, and how it doesn't have to be that way, because that delusion is adventitious. It is not an innate quality of the mind. It is just habit. And so how can we break these habits? So more random thoughts. Compassion is not an emotion. And a lot of people who practice, who are aspiring bodhisattvas, can feel bad about themselves and about their practice because they're not feeling the emotion of compassion. And, you know, shouldn't I feel this overwhelming sorrow about the state of people suffering, and my own, of course, as well. But shouldn't that just create, is spontaneous bodhicitta, spontaneous compassion, is it being overwhelmed by sorrow? And His Holiness, the Dalai Lama, is so clear about this. There cannot be any ambiguity about this whatsoever. And you find really one of the best discussions of this that I've ever seen in a book that is the record of 50 hours of dialogue between the Dalai Lama and the founder of the whole field of emotional psychology, Paul Ekman. Who, along with Alan Wallace, created this program called Cultivating Emotional Balance, and of which I'm a certified teacher. And so I've studied these Ekman's work and his discussions with the Dalai Lama very, very closely. And it's just exhilarating. So they're very, very, both of them are very clear, you know, from the theoretical perspective, and then from the Buddhist perspective, that compassion is not an emotion. And the most interesting way, and so in these discussions, compassion just gets so clearly presented in a way that I've never seen in any simple Buddhist text or simply Buddhist text. And so compassion, rather than being an emotion, is a three-step process. And the first of these processes, so the three steps, attend to, feel with, act for. So those are the three steps. Attend to. So research, so first of all, you have to attend to the suffering of someone else in before you're ever going to feel compassion. And not feel compassion before you're going to be motivated by compassion to act. And so there is a lot of research right now. And so Paul Ekman founded the whole field beginning in the 1960s. He's really the dean of affective psychology. And then he retired, about 2004 or something like that. And since has really devoted himself until very recently to compassion, studying compassion from scientific, psychological point of view. And there are a couple of other really great researchers in that field now also. But he's proposed he said, I'm retired now, but here are 100 research questions for researchers to pursue in the study of compassion. Okay, and so he came up with this taxonomy, really, of compassion. And so attend to. The biggest problem facing people who would like to be compassionate these days, they say, is attention deficit. Because you don't attend to. And so there is, what are the really great studies was done at Princeton. And it was the study of seminarians at Princeton who were going to, and a large part, the majority of their grade for the term was based on the final sermon that they were going to do at the end of the term on the Good Samaritan. And so let's just say there are 20 of these seminarians who are scheduled to deliver their sermon on the Good Samaritan. And they have to, so the research was set up so that they had to, they were all pooled basically across the quadrangle from the chapel. And so they had, and they only had 3 minutes or something like that to get to across the quadrangle and around basically the quad, like a cloister, to get to the chapel, and had to start right on time, etc. So, you know, the clock started and you only had whatever, 10 minutes for your sermon or 15 minutes, whatever. And that was your grade. And so people were in a big hurry. The seminarians were in a big hurry to get to deliver their sermon on the Good Samaritan. And along the way, there was a man who feigned having a heart attack. And so what the researchers found and were quite amazed by was that on the way to deliver the sermon on the Good Samaritan, the seminarians, many of them would just walk over this guy. Because they were so self-obsession is the enemy of being able to relate to the needs of others. And so everybody is so busy right now. We don't have time to attend to the suffering of others. We just put our blinkers on and are marching straight ahead to get to the next task. So what could be better if that's, you know, really the big bottleneck right now in universal compassion, let's say, what could be better than shamatha practice, right? Where you notice everything. You're training your mind to notice everything. And then with the Vipassana practices, of course, what you're doing is realizing that the boundary between self and other is just a construct, that there is no reality to it. It's a conceptual construct. So all of that is breaking down the barriers to compassion. So you attend to, and so I think we can all see how beneficial the practices that we're doing of shamatha alone, let alone shamatha and vipassana, how important that would be for just developing universal compassion. And then, so attend to, feel with. So this is where a lot of people make the mistake. His Holiness says, in that they mistake empathy for compassion. And so when you attend to, the very recent research, actually, just in the last 10 years or so, has really revolutionized this idea of emotional contagion. And basically, this is all based on empathy. So when, and this is the function, the natural function of emotion. It is to be nonverbal, instantaneous communication within a group of humans. You know, very likely pre-verbal. And so it's a way that you can, if you're, you know, you see a, let's just say, you know, Paul Ekman is really an evolutionary or a Darwinian at heart about the development of emotions. So let's just say that you saw a wild animal, you know, a predator, and you were fearful, and you know, then the emotion of fear is a way of communicating instantaneously with everybody in your group without requiring language. So empathy is what we do when we attend to somebody who is suffering, is that we feel in our own bodies the emotion that they're experiencing, which is large, you know, has a very large tactile component or somatic component to it. So their somatic experience stimulates through the communication of emotion, which is nonverbal. And we recognize just in facial expressions alone and body language and all of that communicates instantly. And it stimulates in us the expression, the emotion that they're feeling. And so then we are naturally, if we feel with, then Ekman and His Holiness say that the odds are pretty good at that point then that we will act. And that is what compassion is then. It is not the feeling, it is not an emotion, but it is action. And so compassion really is the, you could say, is the predisposition to act on the behalf of others. You know, and your cognitive framework is going to be predisposed by studying Vipassana, by recognizing that the boundary between self and other, the happiness of another is just as important as my own happiness. All of that is going to predispose you to act when you feel this. And so part of, there is a selfish element also to compassion, both His Holiness and Paul Ekman say, is that because you have an emotional arousal based on somebody else's suffering, by acting to relieve their suffering, you're basically relieving your own as well. That was created empathetically. So those are random thoughts, right? Let's see. I think that's... So, and then, oh, yeah, and then, or does one simply let compassion be realized as co-emergent with the emptiness realized from Mahamudra practice? So I mentioned this briefly yesterday, that the big emphasis, and in our morning prayers, you see this emphasis in Dzogchen, is on ultimate bodhicitta rather than relative bodhicitta. Relative bodhicitta, you develop in the Mahayana, yana, and ultimate bodhicitta is what you're working with here in Dzogchen Mahamudra. And I don't think we're going to get to this. So just try to paraphrase something that Yangtang Rinpoche said. When we are... we'll get to meditation tomorrow, where we basically recognize in our moment-to-moment awareness, we recognize these as the three bodies of the Buddha, the Dharmakaya, Sambhogakaya, and Nirmanakaya. We recognize that this is what the three bodies of the Buddha actually are. Our actual experience of awareness. Oh boy, the thread. And so Yangtang Rinpoche said that when you experience, so the Nirmanakaya is all about spontaneous manifestation. So there are three awareness, pristine awareness, has three natures. Three natures. So the essential nature is emptiness. The manifest nature is luminosity. And the pervasive nature is compassion. And so this is a quality of resting in pristine awareness. And this is why, again, the whole point is to develop this compassion, and liberation as quickly as possible. So in Dzogchen and Mahamudra, the Mahasiddhas and people who have traveled this path have realized that the quickest way to do that is to develop ultimate bodhicitta first, meaning, you know, realization of emptiness and resting in Rigpa, and that then the relative compassion that is basically propels Nirmanakaya, spontaneous emanation, just automatically comes from that. You don't have to work on it. There's no countless eons involved. And so, very interesting point Yangtang Rinpoche made was that when you are resting with these three bodies of the Buddha, you aren't actually experiencing compassion. You're just resting in Dharmakaya, basically, you know, and then Sambhogakaya and Nirmanakaya, but immediately after you rise from meditation, that is exactly what fills your mind, is compassion. And I think for the same reason that His Holiness described, because you have just experienced freedom from suffering. And you realize that everybody has the same nature that you do. And how tragic that not everybody realizes that. So, something like that. Let's dig down to the bottom of the pile. In the progression of the five techniques, is there a specific place for the Asanga method? You could add a sixth. You know, so, I mean, that is, yeah. So is there a specific place? You could fit it in wherever you wanted to. So the Asanga method, so for those of you who don't know what that term means, this is a term that Lama Allen gives to a particular meditation where you are, it's the interpretation of a Sangha of what this phrase of the Buddha, with the whole body I breathe in, with the whole body I breathe out, what that means. And Buddhaghosa had one interpretation of that, meaning with the whole course of the breath, inhalation and exhalation, the body of the breath. And then Asanga had the interpretation that it is with all the sensations of the body wherever they are experienced. So you get the idea right away there, or you recognize right away that in the Asanga method, you're not focused on one particular spot in the body. You're not focused on tactile sensations of the breath at the nostrils, but wherever tactile sensations arise. And so it can be in very surprising places You know, the soles of your feet, the palms of your hand, your back, or, you know, it can move. It can start at your nostrils and then, you know, your abdomen and, you know. So it's, you're really dealing here with awareness rather than attention. Because awareness is able to take in a multiplicity of things simultaneously, whereas attention is selective, exclusive, and focused. And so where, you know, basically you have to recall, of course, that this five-step progression is just my own invention. So you can invent your own. And the basic point is that, like going to, I don't know, some ice cream store that has all the toppings or whatever, you have basically the, what I was looking at there, was using the first three practices that are described in, Ocean of Definitive Meaning as preliminaries, basically, to more breath meditation. Because what I found in my own practice was that, you know, I didn't really feel like doing, dispelling the stale air for until I achieved shamatha. And it is intended to be a preliminary practice. You do that, you know, and then you move on. You move on to vase breathing. But I didn't really feel like I was going to make that my one breath meditation that I was going to do for until I achieve shamatha. And then it is stated also that you can use that as a preliminary for several times during a session and move on. And what do you move on then to? You move on to either counting the breath or fixed at the nostrils, something like that. So you could do, you could easily, rather you could do, Asanga's method would work beautifully, I think, after you do those preliminaries, because again, what you're doing is kind of moving from something that is really more structured to something that is much more open and awareness, you know, just being aware. And then just continue that. And so for me, the natural progression just went from giving up control of the breath right away to and then giving up the breath altogether and just resting in luminous cognizance. But yeah, I think for your own practice, if you like these, if you find benefit in vase breathing, etc., that you would use these as preliminaries to your other breath meditations, you know, whatever your favorite of those might be. And then, is there a specific place for Buddhaghosa's method? Same, you know, I think I just answered that. Buddhaghosa's method would be, for instance, following the whole body of the breath, but being fixed at the nose, you still don't follow the body of the breath, you know, down into your lungs and out. It's fixed. And then when we do the third one, threefold breathing, do we focus on the sensations throughout the body or on the aperture of the nose? So what you're doing there is equalizing the breath, the inhalation, retention, and exhalation. And what are you knowing? You are knowing when you breathe in that you're breathing in. And when you breathe out, you are breathing out. And so Lama Allen says, and whenever he says something like this, he's on really solid ground, because he, you know, consults before he would say something like this. He would consult with Bhikkhu Bodhi or somebody, you know, one of the greatest figures in Pali translation. He says that the Buddha never talked about tactile sensations in breath meditation. So that came, so by the time of Buddhaghosa, who was, seven centuries later or so, you know, and he basically was systematizing all of the experience of these generations of yogis. Buddhaghosa is, you know, talks about tactile sensations. So where, if you're focusing on knowing when you are inhaling, knowing that you're inhaling, are you focused on tactile sensations? I don't think so either. It's a mental experience. You can know that you're breathing in without relying on tactile sensations as an intermediary or a clue to you. And so I think that's exactly what you're doing, is exactly what the Buddha described. When you breathe in, know that you're breathing in. And I think that is why I experienced that, and maybe you did also, that when you get to that point of giving up all control of the breath, and that's all you're doing is knowing that you're breathing in and knowing that you're breathing out, it just feels so light, so easy, so spacious, so delightful that you just want to keep doing it. Making real progress. In Milarepa's quote about meditation is familiarizing yourself with the mind, which mind is it? The sentient being's mind, substrate consciousness, or Rigpa? That's a great question. So I think that what he's talking about here is mind in the way that I was talking about it earlier, the six primary consciousnesses. And that's what we're doing, is meditation is familiarizing yourself with the mind. And it is the mental process. That's the way that I take that. And part of the reason that I say that is that Trungpa Rinpoche was just very, very clear in several different contexts within several different texts that when you're doing shamatha meditation, you're working with the sixth mental consciousness. And he said in direct response to a question when he was asked this, that basically there's not much role at all for the seventh and eighth, so substrate consciousness and klishta manas, in developing shamatha. And so basically you're developing, eliminating the conceptual obsession of the sixth mental consciousness. I feel pretty solid in saying this is the Mahamudra approach, you know, not saying that that's the right approach, or I mean that that's, you know, universal. And I think that Dzogchen, well, certainly the way that I've heard Dzogchen presented is different than that. You know, and you actually are using substrate consciousness as part of your shamatha practice. So that's something that I want to talk more about with Lama Allen when I see him next. So I think that what Milarepa is talking about is that you're familiarizing yourself with the mind, the six primary consciousnesses, and basically what you're dealing with is the sixth mental consciousness, because that's where conceptualization is occurring. And then by the time that you are getting to substrate consciousness, would you say that you're even meditating? And then certainly by the time that you get to resting in Rigpa, you are definitely not meditating. you're doing what is called non-meditation. And so I think that what he's talking, you know, I think you could probably make an argument for both positions, that the whole path of meditation is going to lead you to Rigpa. So you're going to familiarize yourself with that. And before that, you're going to familiarize yourself with substrate consciousness. But I think that in Mahamudra, in these, you know, parsing that quote, that he's talking about the mental consciousness. But that's my opinion. I would like to clarify the term conceptualization. Does the term automatically connote grasping as solid, real, and defining an illusory I as real, solid, and permanent? So that's a question. Let's see. And then when you move to Vipassana, we bring thoughts back into the practice and see them as co-emergent with emptiness. At this point, they are realized as displays of primordial mind. When they're self-liberated, they're still thoughts, aren't they? Question mark. Yes. So there is a, as Lama Allen describes it, there is a continuum of conceptualization. And there is on, let's call it the benign end of the continuum, there is just conceptualizing that knows this from that. So in Dujam Lingpa's presentation of how the world of things comes into existence, he describes this, what I think of as a devolution from substrate all the way down to basically the mental afflictions. And so when you get to the sixth consciousness, mental consciousness, the first is subtle mentation. And so that is basically just recognizing that sound is not visual. It's basically the refraction of light into six different colors, you could say. So there's nothing pernicious in that. So let's just say, or diluted on this end. So you have benign on this end of the continuum and pernicious diluted on this end. And so then you have basically, so that's subtle mentation. Then you have coarse mentation as you devolve further. And then that is conceptual, where you get into name and term. And then, you know, so you're still basically, if I say, is Ed in the room right now? And everybody could say, everybody who knows Ed could just look around and say, yes, Ed is in the room. So we have used conceptuality to, basically conceptuality is always a cookie cutter that is putting a boundary around one thing, and it is something that is not everything else. So Ed is not every other person in this room. He's one person with the name Ed. And so we can answer that question. But is there delusion involved in that? Not really. It's just, we know that Ed is different. We distinguish Ed from everybody else. And then we get over, so that is not, so far, I don't think you would have to say that there is grasping to that yet. But when we get over to this end of the continuum then, this is where we get the process that I've been describing of the mental consciousness projecting a concept onto a percept, and then confusing the two, believing that the concept that it projected exists independent of itself, out there as an external object. And one of the interesting things, so just bring this up, to help us realize what we are up against in this dealing with conceptuality, is that there is a remarkable book written by a guy named Ian McGilchrist called The Master and His Emissary, who this guy is a very formidable scholar at Oxford University. He's a fellow at All Souls College in three different disciplines, which is probably never happened before in the history of Oxford. And so he wrote this incredible book about how, based on the brain lateralization, left and right hemispheres, and how that changes our perception of the world entirely. And what he's talking about, basically, it doesn't seem like much of a stretch to me, is that he's talking about the difference between attention and awareness. And so the one thing that he really points out that is so important, and he has a lot of psychiatric and neurological and cognitive research that he's drawing on here. He says that the left hemisphere, but let's just call it the conceptual mind, is totally unaware of the existence of awareness. And it thinks, it's absolutely convinced that it's the only thing that exists. And it can't be argued into recognizing that. So it's really working within a hall of mirrors, conceptuality. So conceptualization, is it automatically grasping? No, it's a continuum from benign, basically just being able to distinguish this from that, to grasping onto the delusion, the projection of the concept, and insisting that that is real. And then when we do Vipassana, we bring thoughts back into the process. Yeah, and even, yeah, we do that. And we see them as co-emergent with emptiness. And at this point, they are realized as displays of primordial mind. When they're self-liberated, they're still thoughts, aren't they? Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, I think you would say that. And these thoughts are displays of pristine awareness itself. And we'll talk more about that. In alternate nostril breathing, when we start with the left nostril and exhale through the left, do we breathe in through the left, the right, or both nostrils? So I just do it breathing in through both nostrils. So in this way, and I think that's the way. At this point in the afternoon, we have this scheduled, this short period of instruction, so I'll just talk for about 12 minutes and then guided 12-minute meditation on a new technique that we haven't done yet. And I don't know, it seems helpful to do that so as not to overload you, not to fatigue you, and so that this doesn't get lost. So if I had put this in with the breath meditation, I think it would have gotten lost. So this is really going back to the future, you could say, in that this is really the very first technique that the Ninth Karmapa talks about. So we have settling the mind that has not settled, the first group of techniques, or getting hold of that which is not, you haven't gotten hold of. And the very first technique in that group is working with a coarse external visual object. And so this is in one sense going back to the path or to the very start of, and we had already gone all the way to working without any conceptual or without any focal support at all. So in one sense, it's going back, but it's really also preparing us for more advanced practices for tomorrow. So it's kind of an interesting, anyway, I think it's useful to examine this right now. So here, when working with a coarse external object, it could be coarse mundane or coarse sacred, because there are lots of sacred objects around us right now, and that could be our focal support. What we're doing, so remember there are the six primary consciousnesses, five are sensory consciousnesses, and the first one, and the primary one really, is the visual consciousness. This dominates our experience as humans. You know, we're not dogs, so it's always interesting to go out for a walk with a dog, right? Because they are aware of a whole world with their noses that we're not. But we're really dominated, about 80% or so apparently of our sensory experience is really dominated by the visual. So they say, start with a visual object. And so there are a couple of really interesting things. So Padmasambhava and actually other Mahamudra teachers also say, start with a stick or a stone or a flower. So this is probably a subtle external visual object. It's really interesting. And all the teachings that I've had prior to this kind of skip past that and never did that practice. And so it was really because that, you know, I wanted to sample all the practices that the Ninth Karmapa taught. I did this practice and I found a lot of great value in it. One reason that I think it is so valuable, remember that the five sense consciousnesses are non-conceptual. And so to the degree that you are able to do this meditation, really, because that's the whole point of this meditation, is that it is a non-conceptual engagement with a visual object. And so you can really get the experience of what it's like, and it's simple. It's listed first because it's the easiest. And so it really is an easy way of getting the experience of non-conceptuality, or easier than others anyway. And so when we're doing this practice, the point is that we are just engaged with, as the Buddha said, O Bahiya, in the seen, let there be only the seen. And this was really such profound instructions for Bahiya, who has all of Buddhist scripture, he had the shortest time career, basically, for becoming an arhat. He basically, by the sutra, is, you know, very, very short, maybe, you know, 50 lines or something like that, let's say. And by the time that the Buddha got to the end of the sutra, Bahiya had become an arhat. These are profound instructions. Of course, he had very little dust in his eyes, as said. But if you can rest in that non-conceptual state, in the seen, there is only the seen, then this really prepares you for what the experience of non-conceptual meditation is really like. And what we are trying to do is recognize the difference between non-conceptual sensory object and the way that we almost always engage with external objects. Remember, the sixth mental consciousness gets involved almost instantly and projects its conceptual image, its replica, a vague abstraction, onto the sense perception, and then conflates the two and believes that the what it is, its conceptual projection, actually is an object that exists out there externally. And so what we're trying to do is let there be in the seen, there is only the seen. So it's very, very powerful. And then tomorrow we'll talk about how you can really apply this in the third phase of the three phases of shamatha. So it's interesting that this you go back to this again in the third phase. But so in the seen, let there be only the seen, non-conceptual experience. So there are external objects. You know, the first is called a coarse external object. And that is probably going to be the most appropriate for us right now in this 12-minute session, where you just, whatever it is that's in front of you, you just are present non-conceptually with the visual object. You don't analyze it. You don't think of its qualities. And the things, and you notice when the conceptual mind begins to muck things up. And one of the things that is always going to happen, the way that the conceptual mind is going to muck things up, first of all, it will identify it as an object that has qualities. That should alert you right there that, I mean, come on, does this visual object actually have qualities that, you know, obviously, I'm projecting these onto the, but then the important thing that happens instantly, according to the Satipatthana Sutta, is that we like it or dislike it. It could have neutral, or it's just indifferent to it also. But we have a feeling response to it. So notice that right away, whether you like it, you dislike it, you know, is this, and is it identified as a thing? Or are you just present. So the other thing that is really very helpful in this simple experience of resting with a visual object is that your mind has to be very relaxed in order to stay present with this unchanging, let's call it unchanging, visual object, because there's nothing really stimulating about it. And or changing about it, you know, it's not capturing your attention. So you have to rest in the presence, and mindfulness is really just at this point not losing track of the presence of this visual object as your focal support. So your mind has to be very relaxed in order to remain present with this visual object. And if you try to grasp onto it too much, you know, when you see a really great piece of art in a museum or something, or beautiful sunset or a beautiful person or something like that, oftentimes what happens, it seems, is that we grasp onto it and it's as if we want to memorize it. You know, I want to capture this and take it like a photograph in it for my mind that I can always go back to. So if you're trying to do that with this object in front of you, you're just going to burn out and fatigue very, very quickly. And so you have to be your mind has to be very relaxed in its engagement and just relax into presence with this object. And then you can apply all of the elements of breath meditation also, intention, mindfulness, introspection. So all of these elements of what we would think of as later more advanced meditations are there to be practiced with this simplest of all shamatha practices. So there are there's a coarse external object, whatever is in front of you. There is a subtle external object, and that is where you choose actually a smaller object that you place in front of you and you focus on that. So that is more subtle because you have to bring your focus then onto, basically you're selecting what it is that you're going to be focused on. So that's called a subtle object. And there are sacred and mundane. And so one of my favorite external visual object actually is one that Dzogchen Ponlap Rinpoche recommended. And it seemed with great enthusiasm because his main teacher, Kempo Tsultrum Gyamso, had recommended this to him in an intimate setting. And this is a candle flame reflected in a mirror. And it's fun. It's just, you know, it's really, it's, I don't know, there's something about that. And what Kenshin Tsultrum Gyamso said was that it really helps to promote awareness of the luminosity of the mind. So, but it's a fun little image. And so what I got was what seems ideal for this practice for me is I went to the drugstore and got a round little makeup mirror. And you can tilt it, you know, to get the right angle on it. So that basically the candle flame is right in the middle of this mirror. And it is totally mesmerizing. And the candle flame, if you're in, you know, a still room, is still. And it just becomes this metaphorical, mesmerizing experience. But you get a chance to practice all of these elements of just relaxed presence. So let's give that a try. And so find a comfortable position. This will be just a 12-minute meditation. Or actually a 9-minute meditation. That will work, and we'll stay on schedule. So for this practice, your eyes are open and you're looking directly ahead of you. And while you're doing that, you can settle the body in its natural state, meaning that you become relaxed. Quiet the mental chatter to settle the speech in its natural state. And settle the mind in its natural state. The natural state is non-conceptual. So our practice here is engaging whatever visual image is directly in front of you. And in the scene, let there be only the scene. You'll notice right away if you're trying to capture this image because your mind is beginning to numb and become fatigued. So your mind has to be very relaxed. And just don't lose track of the presence of this visual image and let your mind go off to the past or the future. Or begin to analyze it, describe it, identify it, like it or dislike it. Recognize all conceptual activity that is trying to intrude in your experience of this visual image. And if conceptuality does try to intrude, you know what to do with it. Note it. That's all. Don't have to chase it away. Don't have to follow it. Simply note it. It's present. And let it go. Let it dissolve. One tip that is introduced actually later in dealing with appearances, but can work here as well, is if your mind is becoming too entranced with this object and identifying it, turning it into a thing. Just unfocus your eyes a bit so that you're not seeing the precise details and edges of the object, but just seeing the colors, the rough shape. Take a 6-minute break now, and we have 2 full ghatakas of silent practice before dinner, or whatever you would like to do.